These are the PCORI methodology standards. This category is about standards for causal inference methods. It was prepared by Dr. Elizabeth Stewart, a biostatistician in the Department of Mental Health, and Dr. Scott Zeger from the Department of Biostatistics. It will be presented by Dr. Stewart.
Hi, this is Liz Stewart. In this module, we will be discussing how to plan a non-experimental study. When setting out to estimate a causal effect in a non-experimental study, there are many choices that need to be made. First is the treatment and comparison conditions. What is really the causal contrast of interest, and what are the conditions that should be compared? The second is the population of interest. What people or physicians or physician practices or communities are the target of this causal contrast? Who are the people or the entities that are really of relevance for this question? Third is to clearly specify the outcomes and their timing, especially with respect to the interventions under study. And then finally is to think about the data set and the study design that will be used to identify the causal effect. One general point that we'll carry throughout this module is that really a non-experimental study should be planned and pre-specified in the same way as would be done in a randomized experiment. So just as researchers are very careful and thoughtful about how they lay out a randomized experiment, the same care and thought should go into any non-experimental study. The first step is to clearly specify the treatment and comparison conditions. Again, what is the relevant causal contrast? For example, in a study of a new case management program for individuals with severe mental illness, what is the comparison condition? Is it usual care? Is it a less intense intervention? Which of these is really the relevant comparison to compare the case management program with? In another example, in a study of the effect of statins on heart attack rates, what is the comparison condition here? Is the interest in comparing a particular statin with no statin, or a particular statin on no treatment at all, or one type of statin versus another? Another question that comes up when looking at medications as well as other sorts of interventions is, what is the exposure to statins required? Is it one prescription? Is it 60 days of treatment, 90 days? Again, what exactly is the intervention under study or the program under study, and what is the relevant comparison? One thing to stress is that there's no sort of right or wrong answer to these questions. Each of them just yields different scientific questions. Researchers need to think clearly about what is the real comparison of interest, and then what are the conditions that would be compared for that. Again, each of these comparisons, for example, comparing one statin to another or one statin to kind of usual care, both of those are potentially very relevant questions. They just are different questions that might be of interest. The next step is to specify the population of interest. It's very important to be very clear about who the individuals or entities under study should be. Again, this is generally those for whom the causal contrast is relevant. For example, in a study of depression treatment, we might be thinking about individuals who are newly diagnosed with depression and trying to decide on treatment options. The important thing is also to then connect this population with the data to be examined. In particular, for example, we wouldn't want to include individuals in an analysis for whom the treatment choice is not relevant. This may seem obvious, but if we're studying diabetes, for example, we wouldn't include individuals without diabetes in a study of diabetes treatment. While that's an obvious example, there are some scenarios where it's less obvious who should be part of the relevant population and who should not. So again, this is something that needs to be clearly specified and laid out in advance. Related to that is, once the analysis is done, it's very important in study reports to document clearly who is in the analysis sample so that readers can fully understand exactly who was included and how that relates back to the original population of interest. As one brief example of thinking through these questions, I'll discuss the Cady trial from Lieberman et al. In 2005. This was a randomized trial, but again, it's very useful to think about how randomized trials set up and think through these different concepts as a way to then think about how a parallel process can be used in a non-experimental study. In this study, the population of interest were individuals between 18 and 65 years old who had been diagnosed with schizophrenia as based on the DSM-IV. Another condition was that these individuals had to be able to take oral antipsychotic medication, and there were some exclusions, for example, if they had certain co-occurring conditions or a history of treatment resistance. The trial laid out very clear inclusion and exclusion criteria to clarify and specify exactly who this relevant population was, and then only enrolled in the study those who would meet these conditions. Again, a similar process can be used in a non-experimental study where we can subset our data to the individuals who are relevant and appropriate for the population of interest. One aspect of defining the population of interest is that it needs to be done based only on covariates. In other words, characteristics that were measured at the time of the treatment choice or before. This is, of course, obviously done in a randomized experiment where we don't assign treatments until after people are enrolled in the study, but the same process and idea carries over in a non-experimental study. In particular, the definition of the population should not be based on things that might be affected by the treatment, such as side effects, outcomes, or levels of adherence to the intervention. This is also true when the exposure might be a more complex time-varying exposure, for example, people going on and off a medication. Again, in a prospective study, such as a randomized trial, defining the population in this way is essentially automatic because people get enrolled in the study and then randomized after that, and everyone who's in the study gets randomized based only on their baseline characteristics. Another point, though, that does arise in randomized trials is that all individuals who were randomized should be included in the analysis. Analyses may be biased if a sample is later restricted to a subset of those who were randomized, especially if that subset is defined on the basis of things that happened after the treatment, again, such as the level of adherence to the intervention, for example, the number of pills that someone actually took. It is not appropriate to define a population based on those post-treatment characteristics. In a retrospective study, for example, a cohort study where we're using data that's already been collected, we again want to use the same sort of reasoning and define our population based on a defined time period prior to the exposure of interest. For example, if studying statins, we might define the initiation of the statin as the beginning of treatment, and we would look back maybe 6 or 12 months prior to that to define our characteristics and determine who is eligible for the study of interest. You can think of it like the inclusion and exclusion criteria in a randomized trial in terms of the timing with respect to the exposure. The only difference is that we're doing it after the fact, but we will still define the population based on things that are defined at the time of exposure or before. In addition to defining the population clearly, it's very crucial to define outcomes clearly and to specify in advance exactly what the outcomes of interest are. One aspect of this is to clarify the timing with respect to the initiation and duration of the exposure. The outcomes must be measured after the exposure. This might include, for example, the number of missed days of work after 3 months or after 6 months or after 12 months following the initiation of talk therapy or medication for depression. In the CADI trial, the primary outcome was specified as the discontinuation of treatment for any reason. The idea of this trial was primarily to look at whether individuals would stay on these treatments for a long period of time, and so just staying on the treatment was the primary outcome of interest. They also had clearly specified secondary outcomes, in particular the reasons for the discontinuation, such as weight gain, as well as symptom scores. All of these outcomes were measured repeatedly after the randomization, in particular 1, 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, and 18 months after randomization. So again, all of the outcomes were clearly specified in advance, and all were measured after the randomization when individuals were assigned to different treatment groups. In a non-experimental study, a crucial step is to also develop an understanding of why people got which treatment. In a randomized trial, we randomly assign individuals to get one treatment condition or another, but in a non-experimental study, we just observe that some people received one treatment and others another. We just see, for example, that some people received one statin and others received a different statin. So in non-experimental studies, understanding how this process worked and why some people got one treatment versus another can be very useful to help understand how robust our study findings are and what factors might be particularly important to measure and adjust for. Qualitative interviews are one way that can help with this. For example, having interviews with physicians to ask them, how do you decide which treatments to get? Or interviews with patients to help understand, how do you make these treatment choices? How do you choose medication or talk therapy? Again, getting an understanding of how the decision-making process is made and what factors are relevant. This is particularly relevant and sometimes known as confounding by indication, where there might be concerns that individuals receive a particular treatment because they're seen as sicker, for example. And so particular treatments might be reserved for those who have worse health statuses or who the doctors and physicians and patients really believe this treatment might help. A way that this becomes particularly relevant in a given study is to think through whether we observe the characteristics that were based on which treatment choices were made. In other words, was a doctor and a patient choosing a particular intervention or treatment based on factors that might be observed in the electronic health record? Or was a patient choosing with their doctor and with others potentially based on some factors we can't observe? One example of this is this Polsky et al. Paper, where in a study of EPO-stimulating agents, they found that including clinical baseline hemoglobin levels was particularly important. And in fact, when the clinical measures were not available, for example, if they were just using medical claims data, the inferences obtained were less reliable than when the clinical hemoglobin levels were available. And again, this is particularly true if the treatment choice itself depends on the clinical measures. Again, to summarize, the idea is that in order to adjust for the differences there might be between people who get one treatment versus another, we would like to believe that we can observe those factors that led to those different treatment choices, and then we can adjust for them. If we don't observe those factors, it becomes difficult to adjust for them, and our inference will be more sensitive to those unobserved factors. A particular type of confounding is what's known as confounding by indication. Confounding by indication is a scenario where the fact that someone received a treatment of interest is an indication of possibly how sick they are. So, for example, those who receive a treatment of interest might be those individuals who are the most sick or the most at risk for the outcome. This makes it particularly challenging to compare outcomes between people who received the treatment of interest and some comparator condition because the people who got the treatment were likely those who were most sick to start with. For example, in a naive analysis, blood pressure medication may look like it actually increases the risk of heart attacks compared to individuals who are not on blood pressure medication. However, that may be just because it is given to people at higher risk for heart attacks. So a naive comparison of individuals who are receiving blood pressure medication and those who are not may make it look like the blood pressure medication is harmful, when in fact it's partly just that the people who receive it are in fact sicker. Related to that, in a given study, it's particularly important to document the potential confounders in their timing. Again, to think through what are the factors that might be related to treatment choice and to outcomes, and to measure as many of those as possible. As with defining the population, these confounders need to be measured before the start of the exposure, so we can be sure that they weren't affected by the exposure of interest. And this is true in settings with time-varying exposures, too. In reporting the study, it's important to report data on the confounders with the study results. For example, showing the similarities or differences on these baseline characteristics between the different exposure groups. I want to talk a little bit more about the danger in adjusting for sort of post-exposure variables, these variables that might be affected by the exposure. The problem is that adjusting for variables that were affected by the exposure can cause bias. To make this more concrete, we'll use a specific example looking at the link between smoking during pregnancy and infant mortality. Many researchers and physicians might say it's very important to condition on birth weight when doing so. If we're looking at infant mortality or other birth outcomes or later outcomes of these kids, it's important to condition on birth weight. The problem is that doing this can cause bias and, in fact, can make it look like smoking during pregnancy is actually protective and reduces the risk of infant mortality. To think through this more, we can use this graphical model. This figure shows a set of measured covariates C that are characteristics of the mom during the pregnancy or before the pregnancy. Things, for example, like their education level, their socioeconomic status, their health status, perhaps their body mass index. The idea is that these measured covariates might impact whether or not a woman smokes during pregnancy and also may have a direct effect on infant mortality, our outcome of interest. So these are confounders. They're related to the exposure of interest, smoking, and to the outcome of interest, infant mortality. We might be tempted to adjust for, control for birth weight when the baby is born, in part because we might imagine that these measured covariates might impact birth weight, and that birth weight would also have a relationship with infant mortality. The problem is that if we think about low birth weight babies, often it's the case that they are low birth weight for maybe one of two reasons, just to simplify things to be a little bit more concrete. Basically, you can imagine that the low birth weight might be due either to the mom smoking or to some other factor such as birth defects. So in fact, we have this unobserved factor, birth defects, which is related to the birth weight and infant mortality. If we condition on low birth weight, we actually might see a protective effect of smoking on infant mortality, but it's not because the smoking is actually protective, but it's more because the babies who are of low birth weight, whose moms don't smoke, are more likely to have had a birth defect, which then also leads to infant mortality. So the birth defects is an unobserved factor that we are not adjusting for, which causes a sort of spurious association between smoking and infant mortality once we condition on low birth weight. Another way to sort of think about this and to say this is that by conditioning on low birth weight, we're sort of taking away part of the effect of the smoking on infant mortality and conditioning it out. So this is just one example where we can think through this and see the danger in adjusting for a post-treatment variable, such as low birth weight, when looking at the association between an exposure, such as smoking, and an outcome, infant mortality. A final point on planning a non-experimental study involves the crucial question of how to choose a study design and data set. As mentioned earlier, an understanding of the extent of confounding can help to select a study design and data set. In particular, in a given data set, do we observe most of the ways in which we think individuals differ, or could there be some strong unobserved differences? Are some data sets more comprehensive in terms of having potential confounders observed? For example, in some data sets, do we have clinical measures, whereas in others we don't? We would likely want to choose the data set that has a larger set of confounders observed. Thinking about study design, if we're in a scenario where we don't observe very many confounders, we might not have extensive clinical data, for example, or extensive other data on individuals, that might be when we might consider a method such as instrumental variables, which makes a different assumption than some other approaches for handling confounding. So it's very important to think through in any given study what sorts of study designs might be appropriate, given the data that's available and given the research question, in order to make our causal inferences as strong as possible. To summarize, when estimating causal effects in non-experimental or experimental studies, it's very important to clearly specify the population, the causal contrast of interest, and the outcomes. And in particular, we want to make sure that the population is not defined on the basis of post-treatment variables, and that any covariates or confounders are also defined prior to the treatment. Many researchers are very familiar and very comfortable with planning a randomized experiment very thoughtfully and carefully, and laying out the populations, the causal contrasts of interest, and the outcomes. The main point to conclude with is that in a non-experimental study, the same care should be taken to think through all of these things very carefully, pre-specify them, and be very clear and specific about what the treatments of interest are, what the outcomes are, and what the relevant population is.